Welcome to the Boneyard with Steve Robertson. As always, I am your good friend and host, Steve Robertson, here on the magnificent Monday edition of The Yard. It's a great day. It's a great day because we had our first Mississippi State football media opportunity of the season. It's true. Had 11 assistant coaches. We'll break down some of what they had to say later in the show. But kids, we made it. It's August 3rd, which is also now a big day within our family. My youngest sister, Regan, gave birth to a healthy baby boy today, and she named him after my dad. How cool is that, right? My dad's name was Freddie Robertson, and now we got little Freddie. But unbeknownst to them, there was a few days when I was little Freddie. I think I told you this guy's story before, but my name was legally changed when I was 2 days old. Long story, but I was Freddie Dale Robertson for 2 days. 2 days. What a ride it was, right? And then Dad refused to sign the birth certificate. He goes, there is absolutely no way I'm naming this child after that, right? So anyway, healthy new nephew, and he is will likely be the last of this generation, right? Reagan's my baby sister. I think everybody else is done having kids. I know we are. We have four. Reagan has five. And so we are more than happy to let her have the lead for good. She wins. I'm retired from all of that, at least all of the child birthing and raising, if you know what I mean. But I'm pumped, man. I got a new nephew, man, and I'm jacked. I am. And love Reagan's husband, William. He's such a good dude. He's so good to her. And that's all you want, man. Like when you're a big brother, you know, you get a little protective of your sisters, and you're a little bit, you know, particular about who dates them. And I'm not going to sit here and say that Reagan always made the best dating choices. Neither did her older brother, Steve, or her oldest brother, Pat. Pat's been married three times, you know. And so that's not a shot at him. I mean, it's just kind of the hand that life dealt him. But I love William. I do. I love him, and he is not my brother-in-law. He is my brother, and that's the way that I see him. And so we're very happy, and wanted to take a few moments to congratulate the very happy family. And so many of you know Reagan. Some of our listeners in the Madison County area, you know Reagan. Some of you know William, obviously both attended Mississippi State. But it's great. And there's like so much stuff. We got some grass cut today too. Oh my gosh, you know, craziness, man. You're just taking away one stressor at a time, you know. And anyway, it's fun stuff. Hope that you are well wherever you are today. And I hope that all those you love are free and far from harm. And I'm already getting a hankering for another smash burger from Bulldog Burger Company. We've already begun to discuss our dinner plans. And I don't know if we pull it off today, but at some point this week, I will have another smash burger from Bulldog Burger Company. Dana has kind of become a bigger fan of the Black Label Smash. She's had both of the introductory smash burgers. I prefer just the smash burger. She's more of the Black Label. Now, there is also the Triple Smash. Now, this is not for you delicate little keyboard cowboy types, right? I'm just going to let you know that. This is a grown man's hamburger, you know, and there's probably some grown women that can handle it too, but not many. But it's a challenge for you. You get those three incredible patties, and you probably don't need to make any other dining plans on that particular day. So I challenge you, if you think that you are man or woman enough to partake in the Triple Smash, stop by one of their three great locations to serve you: University Drive in Stark Vegas, Gloucester Street there in Tupelo, Lake Harbor Drive in the Ridge and Flowood area. Have the spring rolls as your appetizer to make you and everybody around you better looking. We all need more of that. Yeah. And then get that chocolate shake to go. You can ride that ride home with a smile. What about Burger Company? The place for people to go to meet. M-E-A-T. Okay, we're getting a bunch of questions. And I did my best. I'm not a lawyer, nor do I play one on the internet. I know there's a lot of lawyers that play on the internet. But all that I understood, right, we've had some legality stuff that we've had to kind of get up to speed on. As you guys know, as we discussed on Friday's show, late Friday, the Protect College Sports Act was agreed upon by the SEC and the Big Ten. They now fully endorsed the bill. And, of course, there are some people around here saying, I can't believe they caved. And there are other people that says, I can't believe that legislators caved to the SEC and the Big Ten. Guys, we all had to work together to get something done here. And there's some worry. Will they get the bill to the floor for a Senate vote? Ted Cruz and has shared that, yes, they will get it to the floor for a vote. Then it'll pass to the House. We don't expect a lot of debate and discussion over there. And we got some proponents for the bill over there. And that's just kind of how things sit. And then at some point in the next few weeks, it will head to the Oval Office for a signature to make it law. We don't have an effective date yet. And again, you know, just me. I'm not a federal legislator either. Maybe I should be. I'm not getting a haircut, though. You can forget that. But it feels like to me it would be best to get through the academic and athletic year so you don't end up having some unintended consequences. Maybe you set this to go into effect June 1st. Right? You get through the academic year, get through graduation, get through the regular season in baseball. Softball. And everybody's got plenty of time to prepare for what is to come, right? I think that's an important thing. Now, other people would say, well, you know, do we want this in place before the football transfer portal? Because one of the stipulations of the bill is now you get the one-time transfer. And it's so crazy, too. We're kind of going back. Like, people thought we were being progressive. And progressive is kind of a term that we use loose and fast these days. But we thought, hey, well, you know, we're going to give them the one-time transfer exception. If you transfer a second time, you got to sit out a year. And you know what? Everybody was like, you know what? That makes a lot of sense. Because we went through this phase where if both schools agreed, they could both just sign off on a waiver request and then a player was granted immediate eligibility. You know, we had some basketball players that didn't play a whole lot as freshmen. They played, burned a redshirt year, but they weren't good enough to play here. And so Ben Howland and the schools they went to, everybody just signed off and was like, dude, we don't oppose their immediate eligibility. It's the right thing to do, right? Why take a guy that signed on with an SEC school, gets here, finds out that maybe he's not good enough to play here? He shouldn't have a mandatory redshirt year. And I think that was fair. But it required a lot of paperwork, and there was a lot of things going on. So the NCAA, which is basically comprised of university presidents, mind you, said, you know what, hey, let's just do a one-time transfer for everybody. Okay? We've already got transfer portal. One-time transfer. You can transfer, no questions asked, and just go into portal, and then we'll have a new recruiting phase, and then you can do that. But if you transfer a second time, well, no. You've got to sit out a year. Made perfect sense to most of us because we knew what was going to happen with unlimited transfers. And many of us, including myself, said there's no way this will ever happen. They'll never agree to this. Well, guess what? The NCAA didn't agree to it, but somebody took it to the court system and said, hey, you know, regular students can transfer as much as they want. Why can't student-athletes? Well, the argument that I would make is a regular student is not beholden to an institution. Right, so it's not just the scholarship, right? There's NIL compensation, there's rev share stuff. There was just a lot involved. And I go back to 2020, before NIL was even legalized, and they goes, just wait and see what happens. I had multiple people in SEC leadership said it's going to be a disaster when they can pair up NIL compensation and transfer portal stuff together. And we thought, oh, well, that'd be a nightmare. Well, that's what we got, right? And so then they said, well, unlimited transfers. And so then you had And again, that's the courts. And again, as I said on Friday's show, I am very pro-lawyer. I raised a law student. I have three lawyers. I love them all. But not every lawyer is as well-intended, right? And so what I mean by that is when these lawyers are out here pushing against this bill, it's because, hey, all of a sudden I don't have as many clients. I don't have as many national level cases with which I can drive further business. I don't get my name in the paper as much, not on a national level. So anything that is like a problem is problem for them. Like if they're rooting against it, then I think we should be for it. That's my feeling, right? And so speaking of court cases, you know, on Friday, we also had the ruling from Charlotte Sweeney, U.S. District Judge, that said, hey, yes, the 5 for 5 is applicable to players that began their careers in 22 and 23. But there's problems with that too, right? So here's kind of the premise of all of this, right? So those players that began their college clock in 22 and 23, that academic and athletic year, they're kind of the sandwich class, right? Because just before them were all those COVID players that nobody's 2020 counted against them. Nobody, right? And then there was even some grandfathering that went into 2021. Well, now, the way this is all set up, now the 5 for 5 is applicable to everybody that basically began their college careers in 23-24, that school year. So the 22-23 folks are considered like a sandwich group. It's like, hey, it's basically next level whataboutism. Hey, the COVID guys, they got a free year, and now these other guys, they're getting a free year. Where's our free year? Okay, playing college athletics is good work if you can get it, right? It is. Most of us never had the opportunity to play major college athletics. Now, as somebody who has covered it extensively, and as some of you have befriended many student athletes throughout your own college career, you understand that they have a different lived experience than we do. On top of that, they get a stipend check because of another lawsuit. They get rev share because of the house settlement. They get NIL compensation because it was legalized in July of 2021. So student athletes today are in a better position than they have ever been, not just from a facility standpoint or a resources standpoint or all the gear they get. But in addition to that, they're incredibly well compensated, most of them, at least on the Power 4 level. And so there's a lot of them out there that, hey, we want to stay in college as long as we can. And who can blame them, right? But it's interesting how this this lawsuit has kind of worked its way through. And every day you turn around, there's a new lawsuit about somebody who has been, quote, irreparably harmed. Now, that verbiage is interesting, but there, in some cases, it's accurate, right? And so a lot of these people are like, hey, I'm being denied NIL opportunities. And to me, that's the wrong way to go about this, but maybe that's the only way to get an antitrust lawsuit passed. You know, we'll see. But with all these injunctions and things of that nature, it just, again, goes back to the central point that we need the Protect College Sports Act to be signed into law, to give the NCAA a limited antitrust exemption so we're not constantly in court every time that they pass a rule about eligibility. And here we were thinking, okay, the 5 for 5 is a great thing. And on the football side, right, it gives players the ability to play more than the 4 games. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp.com. You guys know me well. You know that I'm very much an advocate for therapy. We've had a great partnership with BetterHelp for a long time now, but I don't know that you've gotten to see the reviews. We've had some Boneyard listeners that have reached out and said, Steve, I tried BetterHelp. We absolutely love it. You can see those reviews for yourself at BetterHelp.com/reviews. You can see it in real time, right? The reviews are updated daily with hundreds of people saying how much they love BetterHelp and how useful it's been to them. So visit BetterHelp.com/reviews, see for yourself. You'll see why The average light therapy session rating is 4.9 out of 5 stars based on over 1.7 million client session reviews. The feedback from people is honest and earnest. If you've got something bothering you, if you need to sit down and talk with someone, visit betterhelp.com and check it out today. See the reviews, see what stands out, and see if BetterHelp is right for you. Visit betterhelp.com. That's better, H-E-L-P.com. And retain a redshirt year. Well, now redshirt years are just done away with. You get 5 years. We were saving 8 games. I mean, was it really worth the trouble, right? You know, on the baseball side of things, there is no redshirt. There's no limit. There's no cap. It's not like, hey, if you play in 25%, more than 25% of your games, then you don't get the redshirt, right? Now you're giving everybody more of an opportunity to finish school. Most of you don't finish school in 4 years anyway. And there are some of you that are, I don't know, just to say Johnny on the spot, and you can take 5 years and then get not only your undergraduate degree, but your master's degree. Because the majority of student athletes are not going pro when it comes to their chosen sport. That's the reality of life. And the what college was set up to be, right, was to give us a better educated populace so that we could advance medicine, law, science, agriculture, engineering. That was the whole part of it, right? It was to better prepare you to enter the workforce. And now things have been skewed. It's like, well, it's not so much about getting my degree. It's about getting more NIL compensation. And there's a lot of fan fatigue about all of that. And I suspect that with the passage of the Protect College Sports Act, that some of what we have enjoyed will be returned to us as fans. And what I mean by that is yes, you're still going to have a certain amount of NIL compensation. And of course, that's been one of the things we haven't seen the final text of the bill. Is that the NIL compensation should count in the cap. I personally agree with that. Reason I say that, right? You can say, but hey, Steve, we should be able to do this and do that. Okay, fine. Do you think that we're ever, ever going to be able to outraise Alabama or Georgia or Florida or Michigan or Notre Dame or USC when it comes to NIL? We've proven we can't even outraise Ole Miss. Now, granted, they already had an NIL infrastructure in place before NIL was legal. But my point being is, by having a cap and that NIL compensation counts against the cap, well, it gives you a more level playing field. I don't think there'll ever be a purely level playing field, but at least it gives us more of a fighting chance when everybody's kind of got the same amount of money to work with. So, we'll see how that part of it plays out. I'm eager to see the final text. And, of course, Ross Dellinger and others have kind of sent out that, you know, congressional leaders have shared that with the powers that be, and they're reviewing it before bringing this thing to a vote in the Senate. And we have spent more time talking about politics on this show in the last couple of months than, I guess, the entire history of the show combined. But this is important stuff. You know, I am largely apolitical, but when there are political issues that impact what we love and what we support, I feel an obligation to kind of dig into it. And again, even yesterday, as I'm working through this, and I'm speaking to different lawyers to try to get a feel on this ruling and what the clarity about that said ruling meant, there were differing opinions on that. Like, even with the clarity, there were still some holes within the opinion. And as my personal attorney said, I read the whole 50-page opinion. I thought it was brilliant until the very end. And you can tell that a non-sports person wrote this. And that's the big concern for a lot of people about the court system and the federal government, is there's a lot of people that like college sports that don't know college sports. That's what makes the PCSA so important, is because college leaders have had the opportunity to weigh in here. This is not just a bunch of bureaucrats kind of dictating terms to our people and saying, hey, this is what you're going to do. Everybody's had a chance to weigh in and say, hey, this is what's important to me. This is not important to me. And this language needs to be changed. Because You know, when you have people that don't live within the world of college sports, they don't understand. I mean, just like, and again, no disrespect to Charlotte Sweeney, even though I think her ruling was ridiculous. She doesn't understand how the NCAA transfer portal rules work. And that's not her fault. Now you should say, well, it's her business to know since she's ruling on such an important case. And I agree. And maybe, just maybe, it would behoove some of these judges, rather than just depend on their own knowledge base, to reach out to people that actually live in the bubble of college athletics. Because as I read through that ruling, that's the first thing that popped into my head about the portal was, well, why are we only letting players transfer that entered the portal at the end of the year? Because when you graduate, you don't know that you're going to get an unexpected year of eligibility. And so now you're in a situation where if their previous schools don't have a roster spot, well, you're just kind of TSOL. So again, you set up a new class of aggrieved people. And so that's got to be clarified. And of course, this new portal window, like there are some people that have already announced that they're going to go in the portal. And the problem with that is according to this ruling, legally, they can't enter the portal. Right? Because the portal window is already closed. And so by basically having this distinction that, oh, these players can still transfer within this week, but only if they had already entered the portal. Well, why would I have entered the portal if I didn't have any eligibility left? So it doesn't make a lot of sense. It's something that'll get cleared up. But again, we do expect the U.S. Senate to vote on the Protect College Sports Act this week. And then with an expedited order, it'll make its way over to the House of Representatives. And I continue to hear that we have enough votes to have a supermajority on this bill. There will be some dissenting opinions, and some of that is just window dressing so they can go back to their constituency and say, I was against this. You know, and there probably are some states out there that have smaller schools that maybe don't have a Power Four school within their state. I can think of a handful just right out of the gate, and they can go back and say, hey, you know, we fought against this. We didn't win, but we're always going to stand up for you, right? And there's a lot of that in politics, a lot of grandstanding about things that really couldn't be prevented. And this may prove to be one of them. But there's been so many people that have said, hey, we don't need this. We don't need this. Well, the thing about it is when you look back at the absolute chaos that has been rested upon the fans of college athletics in the last 5 years, I don't know how you can say that with a straight face. Well, Steve, there's another way. There is no other way. We've tried every other way for 5 years, and it's brought us here. And yeah, we've had some modest adjustments out there that have helped us. But the reality of it is without federal intervention, this is never going to get fixed. It's just not. Now when you've got, you know, state laws that are in opposition, you know, this state can do this, but this one can't. You know, that's why you need federal oversight, right? And not to mention, the NCAA and the sports that it mandates is incredibly important to the fabric of America. And one of the reasons that I say that is I go back to something that Coach Curry said, Coach Bill Curry, after 9/11. We're talking 25 years ago about. And he was on his way to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, if memory serves me correct. And he stopped at a little country gas station. And the guy at the gas station said, hey, Coach, how you doing? You know, where are you going? He goes, well, I'm on my way for this. And then he said, man, I hope they don't cancel these games. He goes, well, I just got the call that they are going to cancel the game. And the old man that was running a gas station was beside himself. He goes, man, they don't need to do that. And Coach Curry said, well, you know, they're just trying to be safe. And the old man said, Coach, America needs college football. America needs high school football. In a National Football League. We need that because that's where we huddle as a community and as a people. That is absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. And so when I think about in many respects, many fans kind of disengaging due to fatigue about college sports. They're like, I'll just go watch my kids play, right? I'd just rather go do that anyway. And I shared this with some people in Hoover as we began to kind of discuss all this stuff within the last year. And it's one of the saddest things I can share. Is because, man, I'm scared to buy my kid his favorite player's jersey because I believe he'll transfer before my son outgrows the jersey. That's as sad as it can be, man. You talk about localizing the story. How many of you, you want to please your kids, right? And you want to be in a situation where your kids kind of grow up watching these guys play for 4, now maybe 5 years. And have a relationship with them. Like, I go back to Donald Gray. You guys remember him, obviously. Wide receiver that signed with us and went to Colin, came back and had a couple good years. I don't remember the young lady's name, but there was a young lady that had befriended Donald Gray. And every game, she would go to the fence line, and Donald would pick her up and give her a hug, and her mom, dad, somebody would take a picture. And then as he got to be the end of his career, and I believe it was senior day, the picture made the rounds on Facebook of a very tearful Donald Gray hugging that young lady for the last time, right? We've lost that. We've lost the fact that our kids have an opportunity to grow and get close to their favorite players and to go home and make posters and buttons and things like that because that's their hero. And so my hope is with this PCSA passing and stopping unlimited transfers, it's what we've talked about. The Tommy Tuberville said it best. You want to stop all this craziness with the portal, make people sit out a year. And so now we're getting the compromise, which was the original rule, basically. It's so stupid. We had it right the first time, and the courts all screwed it up. But when I begin to think about growing up as a young kid, John Bond was my hero. John Bond, to me, was the best player at Mississippi State, the best player in the Southeastern Conference, and the best player in the country. He was my hero, period. And you weren't going to talk me out of it. Because the eyes of youth see greatness. They don't see. They're immune from the deficiencies that a player may have. They always see the best in people. And for those players, they need people to see the best in them. Because at the end of the day, they get to go out there and represent Mississippi State or their respective school, but they also have study halls and they have all the demands of being a student and an athlete, and they go to practice. And for many of them, the payoff is not just the win. It's all the post-game hugs and the post-game pictures and the post-game autographs, right? And I remember one year when Ani was just a wee lad, we'd beaten somebody that we weren't expected to beat. I can't remember who it was. And he wanted to go see the players. And so we went to the player exit and we waited for the players. And it didn't matter who came out, but he went up and hugged them. And I remember this older gentleman. There were some other guys who were being withheld from media and that sort of stuff. And he turned to one of the coaches. He said, "Coach, turn them loose and let us love on them a little bit. We've lost that. And now we have a chance to get some of that back. And maybe it'll never be as good as it was. But that's one of the things that I think is so important about college athletics is the relationships you build with players. And the relationships players build with fans. I think about Jake Mangum all the time. And the patience that he had with all the young Bulldogs that wanted to get their picture made with Jake or have Jake sign a baseball or sign their hat or their glove. And he gave everybody their 5 minutes. Everybody. Tanner Allen, Rowdy Jordan did a lot of the same. And so when I begin to think about, what the transfer portal has done, to me, that's the biggest casualty. That's the bigger casualty. not just the fact that we don't have their services, we don't have their presence on our campus. We don't have that same love relationship. You think about Isaac Smith, right? Guy that had every opportunity to transfer last couple of years, chose to stay here because he loves Mississippi State, he loves all of you. And he also knew for the rest of his life that he wanted to be a Bulldog. He also understood that by leaving, there would be some people that would be upset, right? And you can't conduct an opinion poll to live your life. But Isaac Smith understands at some point he's going to have to go get a job somewhere, probably in the great state of Mississippi. And if there is a Mississippi State Bulldog involved in that hiring process, they're going to remember, you know what, Isaac Smith was loyal to us. He was loyal to Mississippi State, and he endured some very difficult seasons. And no one would have blamed him for leaving to go win somewhere, but he stayed because he's one of us. You know, I would want to hire that guy because he's not going to tuck tail and run when there is adversity in the workforce, right? Whenever you're up against it, he's already faced greater adversity than we would face with a job, right? And so for the rest of his life, no matter what Isaac Smith accomplishes this year, of course, we hope he has an All-American year and goes somewhere in the draft and plays football for a long time and wins Super Bowls and comes back and brings his wife and kids and gets a standing ovation at Davis Wade Stadium. That's what we hope. But even if that doesn't happen, Isaac Smith will be remembered for being loyal to Mississippi State. When truthfully, he had every good reason to leave. He chose to stay. And that's the thing that is so incredibly important to me, is when I think about the people that I want to surround myself with, the people that you build programs of, you know, the people that you invest your emotional resources in. You want to get the return on that investment. And Isaac Smith has given you another year to do that. It's incredible. All right, time for today's top 10 list, brought to you by closewithblair.com. That's C-L-O-S-E with Blair, B-L-A-I-R.com. Blair Chandler is my friend, your friend, our collective friend in the mortgage industry, as I take my boots off. Listen, we appreciate his support of the show for all these years, man. Blair's been a great friend. He's one of those guys, too, that knows what he's doing. Nobody stays in a meat grinder of an industry like the mortgage industry for 25 years without closing loans. It's as simple. That's the name Close with Blair. We've had several Boneyard listeners that have closed loans with Blair. They will give you their personal review, which will be extremely positive these days, right? Because when the dream of homeownership comes true for you, you are incredibly grateful to those that made it happen. And maybe you could be next. You can't be first, but you can be next. Give them a call or text at 601-500-2344. He will happily return your text or call and tell you everything you need to know. Whether it's your first home, your next home, your retirement home, or perhaps that game day condo that you so coveted, Blair is the only name to know in mortgage loan origination. He's licensed to practice in multiple states. So don't just think you're limited to Mississippi. I had somebody hit me up a while back wanting Blair's number and said, hey, I'm finally back in Mississippi. I'd love to use Blair, and I appreciate that, but you don't have to wait till you move back home to use Blair Chandler. Be sure to check him out today at closewithblair.com. All right, boots off. A lot of spirited messages these days. I'm glad we did kind of a historical lesson with the top 10 list. We're going to kind of continue that because I actually wrote some things on this on my Facebook page about how Geffen Records kind of wrecked everything. And, they were riding high, of course, you know, with Guns N' Roses and others. And, basically thought that they could put a more economic model together. And it worked for a while, but ultimately everybody involved in this conspiracy lost their jobs. Funny how that works. they put all these rock bands out of business, and then they themselves had to go find other means of employment. One of the guys that you guys maybe have heard of is Gary Gersh. Gary was the guy that found Nirvana, signed Nirvana to Geffen Records for basically peanuts. And so Gary eventually got a job at Capitol Records. And he did what's called the Capitol Punishment Day, where he dropped about 20 rock bands at the time to make room for what he thought was the next wave, right? And so I share that with you because I want to give you a little detail here about this. So Capitol fired Hal Mangrum, who had signed Wildside for about $2 million. And it ended up being a bad deal because, you know, music was artificially being changed, right? And Wildside had all these issues. And I think I share with you guys, they were the first band not named Van Halen to record at 5150 Studios. Had a huge recording budget. They were billed as the next Guns N' Roses. Now, I think that's probably a little bit too far. But guys, the album is great. But Gary, you know, absolutely crushed Wildside. Now, they were originally called Young Guns, and they were featured prominently in Hit Parader and Circus and Cream Magazine and Rolling Stone and other places like that. And everybody thought, hey, this is going to be great. So Hang On Lucy, which is on our list today, debuted April 11th, 1992. And you know kind of what was going on then, right? Things were changing. And really, by summer, it was over. And not because Wildside wasn't selling, because Young Guns changed into Wildside, because Emilio Estevez had a problem with them calling themselves Young Guns, and I get that. But it was all kinds of problems. Like they had a customs issue with Canada because they had recorded some stuff in Vancouver. Capitol had to kind of buy their way out of that. And Van Halen, Eddie Van Halen, was so impressed with them, they were going to take Wildside out as their opening band for the Unlawful Carnal Knowledge tour. Remember that one? Yeah. Well, next thing you know, MTV and all the powers that be decided, no, we're not going to do this anymore. So Gary gets hired away from Geffen to take over as the CEO of Capitol. And you guys have heard of the Peter Principle, right? Everybody gets promoted to their own level of incompetence. That was the case for Gary. So basically, they just walked away from this 7-record deal with Wildside, fired a bunch of bands, including Great White. Dropped Great White, who was doing exceptionally well. They had multiple multi-platinum albums with Capitol. They dropped Billy Squire. Billy Squire is an interesting tale, too. That bad video didn't help, right? Dropped the Smithereens. Remember them? Remember what a big hit A Girl Like You was? And they were doing really well on college radio. And that was really kind of more of an organic garage band thing. And so they got dropped. It was, again, it was about 20 bands there. And they ended up bringing in, you know, the big hit for him, obviously, and because he had a relationship with Dave Grohl and those guys in Nirvana, is he brought in Foo Fighters, right? So, like, Dave was putting his own thing together. He decided to get back into music. And so the Foo Fighters, right? So they're like, hey, well, that makes a lot of sense, right? The Foos, I mean, everybody liked the Foo Fighters, right? And I do. I know some people now don't like Dave quite as much because of some personal decisions. I don't let that affect the way I feel about music. Maybe you're a little deeper about it. That's fine. That's fine. I don't judge you. But outside of the Foo Fighters, I mean, you talk about a bad run of signings. And, of course, they thought Gary had the keys to the kingdom because of everything, the playbook that Geffen put together to kind of artificially push Nirvana. And, again, I've detailed this stuff out extensively. But what's so weird about this is, so Gary all of a sudden gets to run the whole show. So we're going to drop all these other bands. And so they get the Foo Fighters, which was, again, a runaway success. But no matter what label had the Foos, that was going to be successful. And then they got Everclear, right? And Everclear used to be a garage band, and they kind of put the Nirvana treatment on them. They polished it all up, right? And I know many of you like Everclear. I don't. I think many of you in the mid to late 90s in a post-grunge world were had fallen victim to some of the same creative marketing. Jimmy Eat World was another one, right? And then from there, it really falls off. Smoking Popes and Mary Lou Lord, that was supposed to be like the greatest thing, right? They thought, oh, this is going to be super. It absolutely sucked. It did. Then Marcy Playground, remember them? Thought they were going to be a big thing, one-hit wonder, right? Now, Blind Melon was already with Capitol, so that's not really a Gary thing. But I share that just because it's like when you go out and you fire established bands that have made you money, and maybe you need to bring in some songwriters to help them. You know, maybe you modernize the sound a little bit. Maybe you do some of that stuff. But, you know, when you stray away from winning formula, it's a mess. And so ultimately, the run of Gary Gersh was pretty short-lived at Capitol. I mean, when you go out, I mean, honest to goodness, and I mean this as nice as I can, when Everclear is the second best band you signed, you hadn't done much. And then the best band you signed was one that basically you had already signed. So it's interesting how it all worked. But yeah, but he was gone within, by 98, he was out the door. And, you know, then went to work kind of repping bands and you know, stayed in the industry. But it's clear that him putting together a roster was not necessarily his strength. So, again, a lot of spirited debate. And one of the things that I have learned about this in the last couple of weeks, I guess maybe an affirmation rather than a lesson, is a lot of strong opinions about this, right? There are some people that have reached out and say, hey, Steve, I didn't know all that stuff. I still love Nirvana, but I didn't know all the other stuff. And that's fine, right? It's you can still like the music and still resent the fact that record labels are evil, right? It's true. They use people like commodities. And it's like as soon as the grunge guys proved to be too volatile, they dropped them too. Canceled tours. Wouldn't work with Pearl Jam against Ticketmaster. And so it all just started falling apart. And then everybody starts dying. And so then like, well, we got to do something. So let's go get this post-grunge stuff. We'll label this as post-grunge. And that'll work. It didn't work. And then we get into the, you know, basically the Starbucks poi pop punk era that worked for a while, then quickly faded. And then new metal came along. And then next thing you know, everybody got back into pop music, right? All the boy bands, things like that. But again, it's, you know, it's whatever's working right now. So what we're going to do, and some people have reached out and say, dude, you talk so much about this Wildside band. Why don't we do a top 10? So we're going to. I checked with Roy, we hadn't done it. Now, I'm not going to do the follow-up stuff because I don't know it as well, but Wildside, of course, you know, they had everything kind of buried on them. And again, some people thought they were going to be as big as Guns N' Roses. In really respect, this is the last big bidding war for what's now labeled as a hair metal band. And so, again, Young Guns became Wildside. But if you remember, maybe you don't remember Wildside, but if you remember buying Hit Parader and all that stuff, they used to have features about Young Guns as the next big thing on the Hollywood Strip. But what's interesting, too, you know, you think, okay, well, there's grassroots means that like a band is like creating some buzz on their own. Guys, outside of Washington, unless Nirvana played a festival, they were drawing about 100 people. I mean, that's the truth. You can go do check yourself. Of course, there's a lot of things online that have been doctored. But Wildside was selling out the Whiskey and all those great big venues on the West Coast. And matter of fact, they shut down the Hollywood Strip to record their debut video. And then the band had to finance their next two videos, and then MTV wouldn't play them. It's crazy. Again, we were all manipulated, every one of us. And we're still being manipulated because now they're just doing it with the streaming platforms. Like you don't get sold your interest. You get sold what the record label's pushing. And what's sad about all this is there's not hardly any money in streaming anyway. If a band gets their song pushed, they basically have to agree to give up most of their streaming royalties. If they don't, they just bury the song. And so it's like, hey, we got to do this because we're only making money. Nobody's selling records anymore. So I got to make money on T-shirts and I got to make money on touring. And so that's kind of what happens. It's like, hey, we'll just deal with the devil here. We'll give away our royalties for this streaming just to get our music heard, so maybe we can sell some tickets and T-shirts. But here we go. Wildside Top 10 off the debut album, Under the Influence. And it is an absolute banger. Like, if you like the 80s sound, you absolutely owe it to yourself to check out this album. Now, a lot of these people, maybe that's not your thing, okay? And that's okay. But I'm going to work this down for you. My Wildside Top 10. All right, number 10, we're going to go with Heart and Soul. And this is a good one to start on. There's 11 tracks on the album, but one of them is an intro to a song that's a little bit later in our list. Heart and Soul is a great place to start. It's an up-tempo kind of a banger. Number 9, Hair of the Dog. No, it's not the Nazareth cover. It's an original tune called Hair of the Dog. Don't let the hair of the dog to bite you, that kind of stuff. It's vocally, it's one of the better songs on the track. One of the things you guys may not know, we talked about how Wildside was so incredibly well received. Brent Woods was a guitar player. Brent Woods was personally trained by Randy Rhoads. Just let that sink in for a second, right? So Randy Rhoads taught Brent Woods how to play guitar, and then Eddie Van Halen let them use his studio to record some material. And then they signed for $2 million for Capitol Records. I mean, dude, how could they fail? Well, corporate greed. Number 8, another great track too, is So Far Away. Really like the vocal on this one too. I like the segue kind of between the bigger stuff and the grittier stuff. Number 7, another good one, a little bit deeper cut on the track, on the album, is Just Another Night. Number 6, this song is a little bit poppy for me. I do like it though. It's kind of like in the Danger Danger vein, for those that know that. It's Looks Like Love. Now, the top 5, absolute bangers the whole way through. All right, so number 5 is How Many Lies. I had a typo on my list to Roy. So there is the intro we talked about. It's kind of a blues thing that's super cool too, if you like that. It's called Drunken Man's Blues. But that leads you into How Many Lies. And basically, it's like, word around town is you've been cheating on me, knocking on every man's door. It's one of those type tracks. Number 4, another banger. Great vocal performance on this one. It's Clock Strikes. And not to be confused with the Skid Row track, Midnight. When the clock strikes midnight. Different track. Got to be a great power ballad on here, and there are a couple, but the best one, and I think this would have been a huge hit. It was not picked to be one of the singles. It would have been had it been my decision, and it's Kiss This Love Goodbye. Not to be confused with the L.A. Guns song of Kiss My Love Goodbye. It's a much different song, but it is an absolutely beautiful track, kind of a sad love song, but man, the instrumentation on this is just absolutely incredible. Again, that's one of the things that we lost. And this is the thing we said in the early 90s, is that the technical guitar playing of the 80s was washed over. All of a sudden, we had a bunch of rhythm players. The guitar solos got eliminated, not because of a fashion choice, but because of a lack of talent. Outside of Mike McCready from Pearl Jam, there's not a lot of those guys from the grunge scene that can really, really, really get after it. And McCready is ridiculous. Like, if you've ever seen Pearl Jam live, it's phenomenal what he can do. I mean, I don't just mean, playing great riffs, but he is absolutely incredibly talented. Incredibly talented. How Many Lies and Just Another Night were both other singles on this album. Which brings us to number 2. Which is probably the only song from Wildside that most of you heavy metal aficionados from the late 80s, early 90s know. And it's Hang On Lucy. And it is an absolute banger. And basically, it's about a girl that kind of goes out to Hollywood and ends up walking the streets. Not so much like Fallen Angel from Poison. But this, and Fallen Angel was good, was great, right? But that was a little poppy. This is not a poppy track. And this is the one where they shut down the strip to film the video. Hang On Lucy will absolutely get you driving fast. And again, if you don't know the vocal stylings of Wildside, this is one that, like, if this isn't a gateway track, you can't go wrong with Hang On Lucy. But number one was not released as a single, but it is an absolute masterpiece of rock music, in my estimation. I got to double check this just because I want to know how this whole thing, maybe I can't get it. Maybe I just can't get it. But we've had it on the show before. It's a song called Lad in Sin. It has an incredible acoustic breakdown in the middle of the song that kind of leads into a blistering solo from Brent Woods. If you wonder what happened to Brent Woods, you say, man, the guy that talented, you know, so surely he didn't drop out of music. Well, he didn't. He did not drop out of music. He did a lot of session work, too. But after he left Wildside, he played on the Vince Neil Soto album Carved in Stone. Yeah, that's pretty cool, too. And then toured extensively with Vince for a long time. He also toured with Sebastian Bach. And now currently is the lead singer in the Gene Simmons Band. Yeah, so they're out touring now, and you got Brent Woods on lead guitar. And he was the guy, too, that kind of fought through leukemia several years ago. He's got a clean bill of health these days. But, you know, speaking of, you know, Kristen Chenoweth is coming to Starkville. You know, they're doing the concert series thing at Mississippi State. Well, Brent Woods played guitar on one of her albums. And so, again, this is a guy that's incredibly talented. And it's a shame what happened to them. And again, a lot of people say, well, grunge killed off hair metal. No, record companies killed off hair metal because they could go sign the grunge bands for an absolute bargain basement price. And then you can cut that. Like, Nevermind was cut in like 2 weeks, I think 16 days for $65,000. Wildside's album had a recording budget of about $500,000. It took 9 months to do. So what do you think record companies are going to do? Well, we can go get a cheaper act, and then we can just throw our promotion by them. We'll buy the end cap up at Best Buy. We'll buy the windows out at Sam Goody, and we'll just push this on MTV. And there was all this like payola stuff that used to happen in music, and still does. It's just called something else these days. But so again, if you like that 80s rock sound, this is a band, too, that a lot of people thought, like, because of the fact they were a product of the Hollywood Strip, that they would kind of fall in that same vein. You know, say Trickster, Firehouse, that kind of stuff. They're not. That's not who they are, right? They're more of a serious band. There's not a sophomore quality to them. And kind of what everybody learned, and I think we talked about this Friday, I think, you know, when the sound scan data became, when they began to, like, scan the UPC, like Skid Row, like it was such a great moment. Like Skid Row's second album, Sweep to the Grind, debuted at number one on Billboard. Not the rock chart, the Hot 200. The Billboard 200, Skid Row was number one, the best-selling album in America the first week of release. And then, of course, Pantera was doing big things, and Metallica was doing big things, and people were like, hey, we need bands with a harder edge. So we don't need guys up there in, like, sequin pants and, like, you know, pink boas and things like that. We need to get a harder edge. And so Wildside was basically, like, if you took Skid Row's first album and second album and kind of pushed it together into a neat little sandwich, that's where Wildside lives, right? They had a couple poppy tracks, but most of it was very, very serious rock. And again, it's a shame that it worked out the way that it did because it took years for Wildside to get their masters, and they eventually remastered it and released the 20th year anniversary, which was great. But again, that's one of those things you look at and say, you know, it's, and again, it's so interesting that people say grunge killed hair metal, which again wasn't true, and then grunge killed grunge, right? And the record companies killed grunge. And then they moved on to post-grunge, which sucked. You know, outside of Bush, sucked. They killed that off. All of a sudden, they put together, you know, Sum 41. and Good Charlotte and things like that. I'm going to push these guys. And then they kill them off, right? That's what record companies do. And people are like, oh, you know what, trends change. No, marketing plans change. It's as simple as that. And it's not like just generationally these things happen organically. It's that we are constantly being bombarded with marketing and promotion. And if we're not on board, then we must be some loser, right? And it's the same thing in rap and country and everything else. Every bit of this is all about the next thing. And then when you get that thing, if it begins to fade at all, then we got to move on to something else. That's how it works. If you have ideas for the top 10 list, reach out, let us know. Best way to do that is to hit up Roy Samanti on X, my friend. Roy's birthday just passed. So maybe tweeted him and wish him a happy belated birthday. Yeah. He was born in 67. Thus the name Dogmatic 67, Dawgmatic 67. You can find him on X there, and also find our great list on Spotify under that same moniker. You can find me on all forms of social media at Scout Steve R. All right, next segment of the show brought to you by Campus Bookmart, a Starkvillian institution. We love Campus Bookmart, and why? Well, they got the stuff we want, right? When it's gift-buying time in your life, just simplify things and just depend on the incredible selection of Mississippi State merchandise at Campus Bookmart. As I unplug this phone, here's the thing. You can go out there and try to get cute, and you may end up disappointing somebody. They'll be nice to your face. Oh, thank you so much. It's great. But if you want to be an absolute home run hitter, whether it's a birthday, an anniversary, or a Christmas gift or whatever, just buy Bulldog Folks Mississippi State merchandise. It's that simple. So what are you looking for? Apparel, decorative items, housewarming gifts, whatever. Think Campus Bookmart. Think Mississippi State. We're not complicated people, right? We're just not, right? So visit Campus Bookmart the next time you're in town. Get outfitted for football season. You don't need to wear those 10-year-old T-shirts. It's time to retire those things. Make them something you work out in the yard in. You need some new gear. You need to rep the brand with the brand new latest fashions from Campus Bookmart. Visit them on the World Wide Web at campusbookmart.net. And by being a loyal Boneyard listener, we'll give you a phrase that pays. That is BSR, which stands for Beautiful Steve Robertson. That gets you free shipping on all orders over $75. Any order less than 75 bones, absolutely incomplete. All right, let's jump into kind of what we learned today. Our first contestant, we had 11 interviews today, and we're very grateful for that. But it is the only time that we're going to get a chance to talk to these guys all year. Right? So it's a trade-off. We got all 11, but this is it. It's interesting, we talked a little bit with Zach Arnett, and it's the first time we've had a chance to speak to him since he took the job. And again, I say it says so much about Zach Arnett and Jeff Lebby that they can both humble themselves and not have any egos involved in this thing and do what's best for Mississippi State football. That's the mark of professionals, right? So I asked specifically about, some of those guys that followed him, and I knew that wasn't exactly the right word because he wasn't technically their coach, right? But obviously he was around. They had a relationship with him. And so he says, hey, the role I was in, I didn't have a whole lot to do with schematics. I don't know if follows me is necessarily the right word. Just because of the way recruiting the portal goes, you can't talk to guys until they're in the portal. So the young man gets in. Obviously, you think he has the skill set that he fits a need you have. You recruit him. But ultimately, they're going to make a decision that's best for them. And I think that credit goes to Coach Lebby and the recruiting staff. They did a heck of a job in that speed dating world of portal recruiting, showing a couple of other guys that, hey, it's a good fit here. It's a good opportunity. Obviously, the opportunity to play in one of the best leagues in college football in a scheme that fits your skill set. They found it's the right place for them, and we're excited to have them. Now, I share that because, let's be honest, right? When you go in the portal, relationships matter. I ask young people all the time, what are those first few days like in the portal? What about those days leading up to jumping in the portal? Because you don't know. By and large, you don't know who's going to offer you. You may have some pre-portal opportunities that maybe people contacted your agent. But at the end of the day, until a coach reaches out to you, makes you an offer, invites you in for an official visit, you don't know what's real and what's not. And because things happen so quickly, as Arnett talks about with speed dating, you know, the school that offers you today may fill their spot tomorrow. So you've got to act quickly. And so you have to have people within this process you feel like you can trust. And that's what happens here, right? Zach Arnett, obviously, was involved with these guys when they took their visits. It's a familiar face. You show up and it's like, oh, it's Coach Arnett. Coach Arnett, maroon and white, telling you about how great Starkville is, how much he and his family are so excited to be back in Starkville. Those kind of things matter. You know, relationships will always matter in recruiting. Always. No matter how much money's attached to it, everybody's got money to spend these days. But you have to be sure you're going somewhere that you can be trusted and that you can trust other people. And Zach Arnett obviously saw Mari Williams practice every day at Florida State. So he knows the caliber of athlete we're getting. So when he's in that meeting room with Jeff Lebby and the other defensive staff, he's like, hey, this guy can do it for us. You can advocate for those guys, you know, once they're in the portal. He's like, hey, if we can get this guy, it fills this need. And so, again, while Arnett, again, kind of being humble here, he was a factor on both sides of that. He was. It's so interesting, too. You know, he was asked a little bit about kind of about just coming back, you know. And that's the one thing, too. You knew that was the money question. You know, you knew at some point that had to be asked. You know, it's kind of taking us through all this stuff. And so it's like, hey, you know, how's it been going? Well, it's been good, said Arnett. Football's football, right? So you get into the daily routine, obviously, your head down and focused on what you have to do and things you've got to improve at. Obviously, I'm very thankful for the opportunity with Coach Lebby. We got a great staff here. He runs a great program, so I'm excited for the opportunity to be a part of it. Obviously, we've got to do our job and go get some results on defense. And that's, guys, at the end of the day, the reason that so many of you guys have been so supportive of Arnett coming back is because you know that there is some autonomy with this. While he'll absolutely talk to Lebby, right, and get feedback from Coach, Arnett was brought in to run the defense, period. Not to have the head coach constantly poking his head in the meeting room and say, hey, guys, did you cover this? Did you cover that? That's one of the reasons that Mike Leach was so successful. He just wasn't involved. You know, I mean, he would be on the game planning side of it, but he kind of let the defensive coaches run their thing. And so you got to feel like that aspect of it is attractive here too. And he was specifically kind of like asked about that a little bit, you know, about, you know, with Leach, and I guess maybe that was Matt Brock who was asked that question. But yeah, we'll get to that here shortly. But Sam Sklar asked him a little bit about any awkwardness. And listen, I know that some people are like, oh, why would you ask that? I think it has to be asked, right? And Sam just kind of comes out and asks it. And so it's interesting. He says, I don't think so. He's torched me every time calling plays, and I think every time I've gone against him, he's gotten the better of me. So there's nothing awkward there, but it's been great. Anyone who's been in this business long enough, you're a professional. It's pretty simple. I tell the players, hey, guys, there's a hierarchy. If I say we're doing something one way, that's how we're doing it. Well, Coach Lebby is the head coach, so he's higher on the totem pole. He wants done a certain way or has a strong belief on something, that's the way we do it. That's in every case. And it's your job to be a loyal assistant and do it the way the head coach wants it done, so no awkwardness there. I thought it was a great answer. It's a great answer. And again, you know, Zach Arnett is a fiery competitor. And you guys know that from his time that he was here. But being around him, he is one of those guys that while he is a warrior soul when it comes to competition, he does not carry himself with this air of arrogance. It just doesn't happen. And you would think that that wouldn't be the case, because most of the competitors, you know, are also, you know, a little full of themselves. It's not the case with Zach. And that's one of the reasons that I think this is going to be a good marriage between Lebby and Arnett. is, number one, Levy needed somebody to just take charge, and that's Zach. But at the same time, too, Zach's not going to come in here and try to create problems and be like, hey, well, this is how we did it. And to be fair, a lot of the things that we did in 2023 weren't great. The things that were good in 2023 were on defense, which is where Arnett's going to be. And, you know, Matt Brock's a part of that, too. So let's kind of segue into some of the things that Matt Brock said. And you can read these articles and interviews for free over Gene's page. You don't have to sign up. You don't have to be a member. You don't have to give us your email address. You can just go look at the website. You don't have to log in, and you can read these for free. You can see the videos for free. You don't have to be a member. Again, I run the show over there, and we want to be your one-stop shop for Mississippi State coverage. And so rather than you having to scour the internet, you know, you should be a member, but you don't have to be, right? So any of the big room stuff we're going to make free for all of you guys. So, you know, Brock was, you know, kind of talked a little bit about, you know, how things have gone when they came in to kind of evaluate kind of the hand that they were dealt. Brock says, I think the first thing I wanted to do was come in and understand how Coach Arnett wanted things done. When I got in, we hit the ground running, recruiting the portal and things of that nature. The easiest thing for anyone to do is start looking for the guys that you like the most. But that really doesn't matter. In any situation that I've stepped into working for someone new, I try to understand how they want it done, and then I do it that way. I sat down with Arnett and talked about what he needs and what he is looking for in the defense, stuff like that. It was simple. After that, we just went to work to find the guys that fit what we wanted. End of quote. Another great answer. And pardon me, that's not Matt Brock, it's Ty Warren. My mistake. But you got a guy like Ty Warren that's won a couple Super Bowls. Guy that's played for Bill Belichick. Guy that's, you know, worked in professional football as a coach as well. You begin to kind of, you know, you wonder how there's going to be a mesh of this. And again, I think Ty Warren has the absolute right idea of how all this stuff's just going to play out here, you know. And you know, one of the things I think you guys want to know about is, like, who has stood out to him. And again, you can go read this in its entirety. Warren says, I think the entire group has in some fashion, meaning they've impressed him. DJ Reed is a guy that's been working his butt off. He's done a lot of stuff on his own and what we've asked him to do. Calvin Dinkins has been really responsible, and he's going to do it exactly how you want it done. I look for Jarray Bledsoe to take a leap in the fall. He's done some good things. Some other guys have to gain some ground during camp. Diesel Moy is the guy that comes to mind. He had kind of been used situationally, short yardage, goal line kind of stuff. He's worked really hard and lost a lot of weight. He was about 350 pounds. Now he's under 330. I'm ready to see how that helps his stamina and things of that nature. That's big news right there, right? That's absolutely big news because, you know, Diesel was the guy. Again, we kind of signed him to be a situational player. Well, he proved to be a situational guy. But in addition to that, you wanted to get some more snaps out of him. And how many times, you know, third and medium, third and short, did we have issues with that, right? We did. And so, again, Ty Warren basically takes over, you know, what the role that David Turner had before. And so the hierarchy of all that doesn't really change. But what does change is the fact that you've got a guy, number one, that has done it at the highest level. You know, David Turner has coached at the highest level, and he has helped put players in the highest level. But, you know, Ty Warren has been there. And so, again, he has some immediate credibility in the room because you got Super Bowl rings, right? You got a guy that has absolutely made a fortune as a pro football player, and now all of a sudden he comes back, and now he's ready to do some cool things and help young people and advance his career. You know as well as I do, that guy's already made his money. You know, he's just trying to get in here and get some things done and still remain close to the game. You know, at some point we all get cut or we have to retire. But that doesn't mean you have to give up your love for the game of football. And that's kind of what's happened here with a lot of guys. You know, they get a little long in the tooth, but that's not the case with Coach. You know, he's still very ambitious, and I'm excited about what he brings to the table. And I can tell you, man, every time that I have been around him, He has been great. Great. Like, always happy to see you. Always excited to talk football with you. You know, he's always got a smile on his face. And it's so interesting. You know, he talked about how much he wanted to coach so bad that he was coaching Pop Warner football. And now here he is, you know, in the Southeastern Conference. Again, makes a move over from Rice. But I don't think there has to be, you know, some incredible acclimation process for him, because he knows what it's supposed to look like. And, again, I think that's incredibly, incredibly important. I had to correct a couple things in this article while I was talking to you guys. So if I seemed a little distracted, I apologize. But we had a misspelling on a player's name. The minimum that we can do is to spell somebody's name right. It's not like it's hard to find that kind of stuff out. But anyway, let's see here. Yeah, let's get to this Matt Brock thing. And asked him specifically, myself, about those conversations, you know, with the initial conversations with Arnett about coming back. And he goes, hey, number one, I always gauge interest in things like that. But Coach Arnett and myself stayed in touch the entire time I was gone. And I think that's interesting phrasing, right? So it's pretty simple, pretty open conversation. This was a place I really enjoyed. My family enjoys it, so it was a no-brainer from that standpoint. Once it got rolling, we made it happen. Excited to be back. And you love that. I mean, you just absolutely love it. And I want people that want to be here. I've said that many times, from the coaching staff to the cleaning staff, that I don't want anybody here that doesn't want to be here, that doesn't think it's the greatest job they've ever had. Not that I don't want ambitious people that are going to do some other stuff, but you know, I want people to feel like, hey, this is a great place to work. We talked about that comment with Leach. You know, how is Lebby compared to Leach? Brock said he's a good mix. Coach Lebby's good at being there and giving input. There are those kinds of communications going on, but he doesn't micromanage and you're always looking over your shoulder. It's a good blend. And you love that. And one of the things that I liked about him too, and he talked a little bit about, you know, the locker room itself, the linebacker room itself. I'm excited about what we have in the room. That was part of the early discussions too. I know a lot of those guys. Every single one I recruited in some part of their recruiting process. Zachary, even Gallette. I had early conversations with before he went to Texas. Jaywin Smith, I'm excited about it because I have familiarity with those guys. We hit the ground running from a relationship standpoint. We haven't done anything yet. Nothing's accomplished until you go out and do it. But I'm excited what the projection could be and the talent level in this group. They've done a nice job of buying in during the transition, and that goes back to the previous relationship. Again, you love that aspect of it. You know, you love God, and the one that wants to be here and likes the players that are around him. Speaking of liking players, Phil Lodeholt was asked specifically, you know, how do you feel about your group? I feel really good, and I feel like we're able to add a lot of depth. That brings a lot of competition, which is something I'm always looking for. I think we have a lot of depth in the room, more competition going into the fall, which is going to be great. We're able to retain some of the guys we wanted to bring back and brought in some new guys as well that I look forward to seeing in camp. We have a lot of young guys as well that we will be developing as we go through it, but I feel really good about that group. They had a great offseason. You want to hear that, right? And specifically, you guys want to know, you know, really about the left tackle spot, you know, really both tackle spots, and he was asked specifically about that. Lodeholt, I feel good about it, and it goes back to the competition stuff I was talking about. This is probably our most competitive spot in terms of guys competing for a spot. You got Saquon Miles, Jakeem Shumpert, Miles McVay, and we have duplicated Miles McVay here. I got to start editing everybody's stuff. There are a bunch of guys competing for those spots, and the good thing is, like all of them, they all have a chance to win a spot. I feel really good about that position on both sides, and we'll figure it out who gets those spots in the fall. And that's great stuff. And, yeah, it's, again, I think Phil Lodeholt's kind of been beat up a little bit, but at the end of the day, too, the proof is in the pudding, right? We can sit here and try to romance things as best we can, but, you know, we've got to be better up front. And, again, I attribute a lot of that to the fact that Phil got here so late last year and the December portal was done. He took some guys in the spring and then tried to play those guys. They didn't get the benefit of spring practice. You lose Blakestein. So I think having some guys kind of unfamiliar with what you wanted to do and trying to catch that up on the fly and having some injuries kind of hurt us a little bit there. But, you know, hey, we got depth now. You heard the man say it himself, so we should be able to get that resolved. And I also, the last interview of the day I posted, you know, that we wrote today was Kevin Johns. Everybody wants to know who the backup quarterback is going to be. Of course, it ends up being one of the first questions asked. But because it's up in the air. We'll get into fall camp where a bunch of guys compete for it and see what shakes out. I think they've all had great summers. I think that's why there isn't a clear-cut number two. I think there's real good competition and we have great depth. Once we start playing football, we will learn a lot more about how that shakes out. End of quote. He's talking, really, it's about Swan and Rashada, right? Everybody knows who QB1 is going to be. I asked him specifically about why this was the right move for him. I think number one was Jeff Lebby and the success that he has had really everywhere that he's been. He and I have been friends for a long time. I've always followed his career. He has had one of the most dynamic offenses every year. To have a chance to learn from him and be a part of the building this program and getting this thing to where it needs to be was something that I couldn't pass up. Being here in Starkville has been phenomenal. It's a great fit, so I'm extremely happy to be here. So I just kind of wanted to give you guys a little bit of a taste of some of that stuff. And again, you can go read it for free. Now, tomorrow, we're going to run the rest of those. Somebody was texting me, asking me a question. And so just to kind of give you a rundown of what to expect tomorrow from on the coaching side of things. And, again, we don't squirrel these stories away. We think you have a right to know right away. But we'll have wide receiver Philip Montgomery, running back coach Anthony Tucker, tight ends coach John Cooper, corners Corey Bell, Vincent Dancy, of course, and that'll run us out. We ran six of these just today, and we'll run five tomorrow. And then we'll get into the midweek, and then we'll see where Thursday takes us. You never know, you know, what the next media availability is going to look like, but there's supposed to be something on Thursday. And we'll let you guys know on Wednesday show what that's going to look like, if that's, you know, if that's an observation of practice or if it's just a media op after practice, we don't know. But no matter what it is, we're going to be there. All right, final segment of the show brought to you by the Stark Vegas Clubhouse, the best place to stay in the Golden Triangle, bar none, especially when you're bringing a large group to town. And you should. You absolutely should. We stayed there. We had a great time. It was so nice having everybody under one roof. When you get a chance to do that, you know how special it is. Whether it's a family weekend or a friend's weekend, they can accommodate you. You'll be glad that you stayed there and frequented their establishment. It's the old renovated country club clubhouse out past the Highlands. Yep. And 5 minutes away from the Mississippi State campus. Do your tailgating right there. You go to the ballgame, come back, watch more college football. You know, if it's not a ball game weekend, you got some vacation time that you need to use, think about the Stark Vegas Clubhouse. Open 365 days a year. Now, Google the Stark Vegas Clubhouse, and you can find their Facebook page and peruse all the pictures of the amenities available to you and your guests. That's the full-service kitchen, the wet bar, the back porch area, the fire pit area, plenty of parking. Six bedrooms, two soon-to-be three baths. It's a great place to stay. Incredibly comfortable. Incredibly quiet. You love that too, right? We want to keep it quiet too. So we don't need you throwing any ragers out there. But you can go have a great time at the Stark Vegas Clubhouse. Be sure and check it out today. All right. Back on August 1st, we had a moment. I logged on to Facebook. I was laying in bed. Woke up. And like all of you, first thing I do is grab my phone, check out social media, see if I've missed anything in the night. More times than not, I haven't. But the first thing that I saw on Facebook was a post from Sarah Looney, a mother of DJ Looney, who passed away 6 years ago on the 1st. And she had made a post about DJ. And I responded. Then I thought to myself, you know, I can do better than this. So I wrote a story about DJ. And that's one of the best things about having a platform like I do is you can get the word out to people. And you find out how much somebody is truly loved when something like that happens. And I have heard from so many former Bulldog players, coaches, other coaches around the South, players that were with DJ at East Mississippi, others that were with him at Central Arkansas. I think just about everybody on the Louisiana Lafayette staff has retweeted the piece. And in no way is this to shine a light on me or anything that I've done. But when I wrote the dude, I stumbled across a quote. I closed the book with it in many respects. And I'm trying to look it up for you now. Just because of the fact I want to speak about this. It's Ernest Hemingway. And he says, every man has two deaths, when he is buried in the ground and the last time someone says his name. In some ways, men can be immortal. And I think that's one of the most important and poignant points in life. Is we owe it to those we love and have lost to continue to say their names. Now, Duty Noble is a name that will live forever. As long as we have a baseball stadium, his name will be spoken. And even when I wrote that book, there were some people that didn't realize who he was or what he was about. And some thought he was a donor. When they went to go pull his transcripts, a couple of kids that were helping the registrar's office said, are you sure he went to school here? Well, I'm sure DJ Looney went to school here too. And he was my friend. And for those of you that remember when he passed away, I got very emotional on the show. And I still get a little emotional sometimes thinking about DJ, and it was a lot of fun to write that article, but it was kind of sad too. I would rather have just kind of written a good time an article about DJ and he and I had a laugh over it, but he's not here to do that with me. And it's been very rewarding to have people hit me up. Even Cody Kennedy, former Mississippi State offensive line coach, hit me up and says, hey man, thanks for making a grown man cry today. You know, I think to myself, as these texts and direct messages and Facebook messages have come in from so many of you, but even more so the people whose lives that he touched that we never knew about, that is the testament of great humanity. You write a story like that, and other people are so maybe aligned with you and your personal loss, and they're feeling the same emotions because of a guy that really didn't play a whole lot at Mississippi State. And that's one of the things that I think about that speaks to maybe the glory of who DJ Looney was, that he wasn't a football superstar here at Mississippi State. He was a backup. He was a special teams guy. But he was so incredibly involved, and he loved Mississippi State so much, and he loved all of you. One of the things that I wrote about is after Dan Mullen had taken a job at Florida, DJ didn't get the opportunity to go to Gainesville. Wanted to stay here in any capacity whatsoever. He was your tight ends coach. He replaced Scott Sawitch in 2017. Wanted to stay on and coach anything. And wasn't given that opportunity. I'm not blaming anybody. That's the business, right? But he loved this place so much. And he loved this town so much. And he loved this fan base so much. And he loved our players. And he called me. And he said, we're going to win this game. Talking about the 17 Outback Bowl. We beat Lamar Jackson. He said, we're going to win this game. He said, man, these kids have been through so much. And they had. You know, the Egg Bowl, they got to see Nick Fitzgerald lay it out on the ground and cart it off the field after a cheap shot. They lose their quarterback, lose the golden egg, then lose their coaches. And DJ was part of a renegade staff in many respects, a bunch of GAs and QC guys, led by Greg Knox, the interim coach, before he went to Florida. And they found a way to beat the Heisman Trophy winner in his final game. Mark McLaurin set an Outback Bowl record with 3 interceptions. Was it the Outback Bowl, Gator Bowl? I don't remember. Gator Bowl, yeah. And so I share that because I don't think you knew. And then ultimately it proved to be the last game that DJ Looney was a part of as a Bulldog. And so he went out as a winner. And every time he would call me, which was pretty frequently, especially in the spring when they're out doing their spring evaluations, he'd be out on the road and get bored. And like me, that's when he would catch up on all his phone calls. You know, I'd call my sister and, you know, my brother and people like that. But that's what DJ would do. And he goes, hey, dude, if you hear of anybody, you know, you recruits out there, let me know. Right? He was at Louisiana Lafayette then. And I missed those phone calls. Not just because of the fact that I enjoyed connecting with my friend, and not just because I was helping my friend. What I miss about those is the collaborative effort to help a young man have the opportunity to play college football. I miss that. I miss being able to help a young guy that maybe is not good enough to play at Mississippi State to get on the recruiting radar of a school where perhaps they can play. And DJ provided a lot of that for me. There'd be a lot of guys, I got a lot of emails, a lot of messages. Not as many emails as it used to be. Nowadays, it's all direct messaging on social media, it seems. And people say, hey, I've got a kid. And they'll have college level size. You watch the film, they're a little bit raw. And you think, hey, this kid's got some potential. And a lot of times you get some videos and the kid doesn't have any potential. But when you find that guy and you think, hey, you know what? This may be a guy that DJ could use, right? And so I helped him when he was at East. I helped him when he was at Central Arkansas. He didn't need my help when he was at Georgia. But I share all that with you guys because, you know, you never know where life's going to take you. And you never know what relationships are going to matter to you, especially as you get a little bit older, right? It's tough to make new friends when you get older. Because we kind of get caught in their own ways. And I'll be honest with you. Sometimes people invite me to go do stuff, and I just don't have the energy to go. It's got nothing to do with them. It's got nothing to do with their personalities or my interest in them. Sometimes I just don't have the energy to go. But every time DJ called me, it always just kind of turned, whatever day I was having, it enhanced my day. And you have people in your life that I'm sure that you feel the same way about. Like every time you get off the phone with them, you just feel better. And DJ had that magnetism. Today I'm leaving the complex and Deontay Evans from Macomb High School was there and visiting with Gary Green. And he brings up the article, you know, about DJ. And I told him, I said, man, I've heard from so many former players about the piece. And again, it's not me. I just kind of shined a light on somebody that we all loved. And I think to myself, you know, why do we have to wait for somebody to pass before we give them their flowers? You know, how many people in my life and in my circle of influence do I love and maybe I don't tell them enough? You know, I joke with Dana all the time. I said, I don't tell you I love you enough. She goes, you tell me all the time. I said, it's still not enough. I was on an interview one time, and one of these, you know, recovery life lessons type interviews, and somebody asked me, what is your biggest fear? I didn't have to think about it because I've thought about it many times. My biggest fear is that I will die and the people that I love the most will not know how much I really love them, despite the fact that I may tell them. It's never enough. And can we ever tell each other that we love each other enough? You know, like I've got some male friends, I'll tell them I love them. And, you know, years ago, you know, that was kind of unheard of. You know, it's like Chad and Ashley Jones, some of you guys know them. I love them. And I'm so glad they're a part of my life, and I wish I could spend more time with them. And like, every time I see Chad, one of us will go first, but it's always, I love you, brother. And I think to myself, why were we in the 90s or whatever, why were we so afraid to just kind of share that type of brotherly love with each other? You know, there's nothing wrong with telling people that you love them. You know, love is not always a romantic love. And yesterday was my stepdad's birthday, and called him. And sometimes I think about that aspect of it too, the responsibility that he took on, you know, to raise two boys who weren't his. And that's not to say my dad wasn't in my life. He was incredibly involved in my life. But my stepdad never had any kids of his own. But he loved us like his own. And I call and talk to him every now and again. I had a snake out here a while back and took a picture, and I thought I was pretty sure what it was. And sure enough, I was correct. But it gave me an opportunity to text and then talk to him on the phone. And I always make sure, because I mean, they're getting older, you know. And he's 78 years old now. And I joked with him yesterday. I said, did you ever think you'd live this long? And he goes, I never even really thought about it until the last few years. And those are the things we think about. None of us are guaranteed tomorrow. And as I've shared on this show before, none of us are guaranteed that bedside visual where you get to this look around the room and you're cognizant of everything that's going on and you tell everybody how much you love them. You're not guaranteed that. So tell them now. Tell them you love them now. Because I love all of you, whether you love me back or not. You know, I tell people all the time, I don't have hate in my heart for any individual. I hate some things. I hate some ideology. I hate some political policies and things of that nature. And it doesn't matter who's in office. There's things that I'm always going to be disappointed about. But I don't hate a person. I hate some things people do from time to time. And I hate that some people are so willfully ignorant. But as far as hating another man, I don't. There are some people I like more than others. But I just don't live with hate in my heart. And that's long-term recovery stuff for me, because I can promise you there have been many times in my life that I have hated people. And sometimes I felt that I had good reason to. And maybe in the emotional moment, you do, right? Because you're so hurt. But eventually, as time passes, you got like, I remember Scott Sorensen. You guys know, those of you that are frequent and fond of it, you know, Scott Sorensen was one of my best friends and became this very accomplished artist. And I'm so proud to have known him. He said something one day that I called somebody a butthole, but I didn't use the PG-13 version. He goes, Steve, don't say that. And I said, well, he is. He goes, no, he's not. You can say he's acting like one, but to say that he is one means that he's not capable of any type of behavior. And I believe he can turn this thing around. And I've meditated on that over the years. You know, we get so hung up on labels, right? And my generation, like, we fought so hard to not label people. Like, hey, we're just people. And nowadays, people want to be labeled, like that's become their identity. You know, well, I'm this and I'm that. It's like, I mean, goodness gracious, you log on to some social media stuff and it's like, hey, my name is so-and-so and I suffer from this and this and this and this. It's a whole laundry list of self-diagnosed ailments. And it's become their identity, right? And one of the things that I fought against a little bit in recovery, in my own recovery, is there was a trend for a while that people would say, well, I'm an alcoholic and my name is Steve. I tried it on for size a little bit and it didn't fit for me because I felt like I was putting the cart before the horse. I'm Steve. And I suffered with alcoholism. I suffered with chemical dependency, but that's not my identity. I will always be a drug addict. I just don't partake in narcotics anymore. But I don't have to go out there and identify as that to establish any credibility. I think the life I lead and the words that I express are enough. And so I share that just because of the fact there is this trend today to self-label. I just think it's a horrible way to live. It's like we're constantly ruminating over our problems. I mean, you don't see people walk up to you and introduce themselves and say, "Hi, my name is John. I'm a divorced, bipolar depressive that struggles with OCD, and I like wearing, lime colored socks." It would be so silly if that's how we did it. And in nowadays, it's like we want to do it on social media because it gleans attention from people. And I've had some discussions recently online that somebody said, "Well, I am this, 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 and this, and then this person hurt my feelings." And I responded and I said, "Well, none of that other stuff matters. You're a person. You're a human being that had a conflict. And all of your self-diagnosed ailments had nothing to do with the conflict." And you're like, "Well, I just wanted to provide some context." The context is unnecessary. Somebody mistreated you, not knowing that you had these ailments or that you think you do. You're just another human being that had a difficult interaction with another human being. And I think that's one of the most important things in life, is to see each other as human beings. We all have a cross to bear. And I suspect that if all of us went and sat down and took a battery of tests, we would find out that we'd be diagnosed with a laundry list of things. Right? And maybe that it would explain a lot about our behavior. But I remember the day that, people told me that I was an alcoholic and an addict. And the truth of the matter is, I always knew it. I just couldn't bring myself to admit it. But by somebody else saying, "Steve, this is you have a problem," I felt in some ways it kind of let me off the hook, because it kind of excused some of my negative behavior. And I'll be honest with you, not all of my negative behavior can be attributed to alcohol and narcotics. I made some really bad decisions, even in recovery. I've hurt people in recovery. I've had behavior that is beneath my character in recovery. But you do your best to make amends, and you forgive yourself, and you move forward. It's just like, it was something I saw recently. I can't remember all the details on it, but it was something happened with this guy when he was like 20. And it was like he didn't really hurt anybody, at least not physically. And he's like in his 70s. And people are like, "I could never, ever support this guy because of this." Guys, that's not his problem. That's yours. You're the one living in the past, not him. It's like, "Oh, when he was a kid, he did this." Well, how many bad things did you do when you were a kid, right? And so I share those things just because we just have to offer some grace to each other. And one of the things that I share with people in recovery all the time is, let's offer grace more often than we ask for grace. I think if we did that, the world would be a better place. There are some things, like I know that there are some people within my life walk on eggshells around me. And maybe it's because in the past that maybe I've had to dress some people down, right? But it's always so interesting when people are like apologetic over something that is pretty minor. It's like, "Hey man, I'm sorry, it's not a big deal." Okay. And I know it just kind of disarms people. They hate to tell me that. I got some people that hate to disappoint me. And I don't like to be disappointed, but I understand it's part of life. But I think communication is everything. And one of the things that I have committed to do later in my life, this is the process now, is to try to give those people a soft place to land before they ask for it. To let people know ahead of time with some dialogue, "Hey, I need to get this taken care of. Listen, here's kind of my timeline on this. I don't want it to get swept aside, but also, too, I don't want you to drop everything, go do it now," right? And as long as it gets done, things are going to be fine. And things don't get done, I may remind them nicely one time, but after that, I probably will be a little more demanding, right? But one of the things that I have learned about all of this, about extending grace and about loving other people, is it is so incredibly important to not let people live with misconceptions about how you feel about them. And I've had that in my professional life. I had a long discussion about 2 years ago with somebody that I can't say we're ever going to be best friends, but we now have, you know, a relationship where we can work, you know. And it was all about a misconception. It was a misunderstanding about something that happened ages ago. And I asked this person, you know, what's the problem? And they told me. And I was like, I never, ever, ever. That had nothing to do with you. Not, that was never intended to harm you. And I explained myself. I was like, hey, this was that was that was about. And you're like, dude, I wish I had known. And maybe it wouldn't have been like this all these years. And how many of those conversations do you need to have with somebody, right? Sometimes just sitting down and just asking somebody, what is it about me that bothers you so much, right? There are some people that are going to dislike you for no reason whatsoever. They're not going to have a good reason, and you don't need to give them an excuse by you know, blowing up in their face. But the reality of it is that life is so much easier when we open our mouths, but also open our ears and give people a safe space to kind of explain why they feel the way they do. And I hope that you guys are feeling great as you listen to the show. A little bit longer than usual, so we're going to get out of here, man. But if you hadn't done so, visit DirtyNobleBook.com. You get signed copies of all my sports titles, of course, Flim Flam, Stark Villains, Alpha Dogs, Dogpile, The Dude, and the personal memoir, When the Bottom Falls. I think it's a book everybody would benefit from reading, whether you're in recovery or not. Come float What Is It True West Float Spa of Starkville, 662-268-7601 to get more information. And come join us over at JeansPage.com. But until next time, let's all live our lives in a way we make more friends than enemies, and people can see a difference in the way we live.